Today on Central Standard, we remember a local figure who believed that anyone could write a good poem if they were willing to do the work. The late Phil Miller was a poet and a mentor who co-founded the Riverfront Reading Series Showcase. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's show, we'll hear some of his work and learn more about his determinately democratic approach to poetry. Plus, later in the show, a KC native has directed a new film exploring the cultural and historic forces that gave rise to the black punk funk band from South Central LA, Fishbone. Hear how they combined the punk and funk genres and, in the process, challenged racial stereotypes of the music industry and music fans. Get ready for a show of artists breaking from cultural norms. That's ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. The Ode, it's an intricately composed poem that lauds, commemorates, glorifies an individual or pivotal event. For our guests today, the late great Kansas City poet Phil Miller is a subject in and of himself, inspiring the ode to him and the local events he shaped. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Joining us now are poets Randy Ratliff and Eve Ott, who are here to tell us about Phil Miller, his work, his legacy, and an upcoming tribute series in the form of an open mic this Sunday from 2 to 4 at the Writer's Place. Randy, Eve, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jabalani. Thanks.
Hi. Thank you.
Who was Phil Miller?
Oh, that's a big one. Phil Miller was known by his friends and admirers as the godfather of poetry in Kansas City for more than 20 years. He taught largely at Kansas City, Kansas Community College, and sponsored, created, I think, the oldest reading series, poetry reading series in the city, the Riverfront Reading Series. He was a charter member and longtime board member of the Writer's Place, and he was, more than anything else, a champion of the idea that poetry is for everyone. It's not just an academic endeavor, and that, in fact, anyone, as we all like to say, and he would say often, anyone can write a good poem if they're just willing to do the work.
And we'll definitely expound on that as this hour proceeds. Eve, what did his personality inspire, Phil Miller's personality? We talked about the man and his accolades and what he did.
Phil was in many ways a community organizer. He created community wherever he was, here with Riverfront Reading Series, which is being continued by a group of fellow writers and friends, and the Collaborators, which was a reading group where we get together to share and give input on each other's work. He truly believed you could grow and learn to increase your skills as a poet. And that was his main thrust. He was a great educator and a great friend.
And that's one of the things that Randy just brought up. One of his most memorable poetic theses, his literary premises, was that, as you said, Randy, anybody could write poetry if they were willing to work. Now, what does that mean to you? Because there are a lot of air quotes, you can't see it, poets out there. What does work mean to you?
Oh, well, how much time do we have? Like any form of endeavor, poetry has its craft to it. I can say that something is beautiful, or I can tell you that it is blue and sparkly and shaped in a certain way. Or I can try to give you, through intense language, a more intense, direct experience of that beauty. Instead of describing it to you, I can make that experience itself pop off the page. So I'm not describing, but you're more directly experiencing. And it's cultivating the craft to be able to make something that does that in language, that transforms ordinary language into poetry. And that is not a definitive definition by any means. I don't think there is one.
Mr. Miller seems to be observational and conversational in his approach. Eve, talk about the work from that standpoint.
Absolutely. Phil was a student of human nature. He found our foibles endearing and humorous. He could be quite humorous in a lot of his poems. He used everyday language with a twist. There would, for instance, a title of one of his anthologies is Chance of a Ghost, which is a flip of Ghost of a Chance. And he did that kind of pattern repeatedly in his work. I'd like to add to what Randy said about the work part. As anyone listening who writes will probably relate to this, sometimes I'll get a sudden attack of poetry late at night, and I'll write furiously. I'll say, oh, my goodness, that's wonderful. And the next morning I read it over and I say, what was I thinking? You know, that's when the work begins, the refining. And it's very, very helpful to have input from other writers, too.
So did Mr. Miller help foster the morning clarity after the sudden attack? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes, he wouldn't let you get away with, quote, inspiration. You had to hone, you had to refine, you had to eliminate anything extraneous to what you were trying to get across.
First drafts are only raw material.
That's right.
It's a happy accident if you come up with a first draft that is actually a fully crafted piece. I know I never do.
What Mr. Miller seems to espouse in some of his works is not necessarily the process of writing, but the process of rewriting. Would you agree with that, Randy?
That's the craft. I mean, you have your observation, you have your inspiration, you have that moment, whatever it's made of, that has you putting words on paper. That's an impulse. And then there's the discipline of the crafts person making those choices. One of the things that happens most frequently when you scribble down that inspiration is that you rely on cliches and familiar phrases and that sort of thing, which is the opposite of fresh language. It's precisely the kind of language that puts people to sleep. And what you want to do is flip it, like Chance of a Ghost, which alerts the reader that something new is happening, and they begin to pay closer attention. And once you're paying closer attention to something, it's better able to move you and even change you in some way. So it's working that craft on your raw material that elevates the work.
How does that translate to a work such as George Grant to His Public, which you're going to read for us in a moment, Randy, but give us a preface on that sort of translation of grabbing facts and observations out of the air, putting them on paper, and then having to craft it down, sand it down.
I think it's a great place to start. Phil struggled with alcoholism for much of his life and did overcome it. And for the last many years of his life, he walked around with a near beer and was happy to make cocktails for other folks. But he was done with alcohol. Part of the process, and I don't mean it was therapeutic, but part of what he did as a poet when he was getting away from alcohol was that he wrote these poems of this character, George Grand, who is a full-out alcoholic and unapologetic about it. And this character, this persona, makes observations about life from that skew point of view. And so Phil reclaimed himself and his art and by dealing with his alcoholism, not as a confessional thing, but by creating this character who could present what was universal in that very narrow and specific and sad sort of experience.
Well, let's hear what George Grand to His Public has to say to His Public.
All right. This is in fact, from a chapbook of a series of poems called George Grand. This is George Grand to His Public. I want you to know, though I'm a goddamned rummy, no doubt about it, and get myself into a mess now and again. When you see me leaning on a pole like the red-nosed character on that famous lamppost ashtray you can still find in a Salvation Army thrift store or some old lady's parlor, don't think what I have to say is for nothing. I mean, a drunk gets to see a side of life that's meaner, closer to the bone, and you might think I'd be better off in some halfway house or mission. But I've got a little problem with faith, as you may yourself, looking down your nose at me. And besides, I'm not ready to give up yet. Everyone knows a drunk's always half right, which is better than dead wrong, like some I know, sober as judges, trussed up, walking stiff and straight, walking the line, but needing a drink, if you know what I mean, real bad.
That was George Grand to his public, written by the late, great Phil Miller, luminary of Kansas City's literary tradition, and it was read by Randy Ratliff. Today we're hosting a tribute for that late, great poet, Phil Miller, who passed away on Valentine's Day. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR and KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guests are poets Eve Ott and Randy Ratliff, whose voice you just heard. Tell us more about the essence of the Riverfront Reading Series and how it actually came about. Not the facts, but the take us a little VH1 behind the music, sort of.
Well,
what is the behind the scenes backstory?
Well, I always start with the facts. Phil and Don Blevins, another writer, began the series in 1986 called Riverfront because it began at the Artists Coalition down in the River Market area right near the river. It is a series that has focused on local and regional writers, usually two writers, almost always two poets, sometimes a poet and a fiction writer, with a musical interlude between the two readers, always some snacks. And it was intended to be not just an artistic presentation, but also that community that Phil was always cultivating. It was local writers, and it was a regular community of local attendees. It also always concluded with everybody being invited to one dive bar or another after the reading to decompress and talk about anything at all, talk about the poetry, talk just to be that community, to be what I suppose a lot of writers wish they could be, a member of a larger group of folks who they could talk to about their own concerns. Riverfront's gone on a long time, and it still keeps to all of those traditions. Even I've each had a reading with Riverfront, and a lot of other fine folks have as well, who are just rank-and-file folks, not academic poets, not luminaries of any kind, but people who've done good work that needs to be heard.
That blue-collar work ethic is what went into the founding of the Writer's Place. You said he was a charter member, Eve.
Yes.
Tell us about how that space, a sort of cottage-like atmosphere, quiet as a church mouse in there, how does that meet the needs of the KC writers?
It's a community? Wonderful gift to the community. It gives a lovely venue, really. When we have out-of-town or out-of-state poets who read there, they're always so amazed at the facility itself, that it has a certain grace to it, despite the fact that it's haunted. And also, in addition to sponsoring many readings, the Writer's Place also holds many workshops for writers. There are several writers' groups who meet there. There's our open mics once a month for people who want to try out their poetry or fiction. And it's just a fantastic gift to the community.
Mr. Miller said you can write something that works and it moves you, but it might not be great, but you'll be effective. Expound on that. You can write something that works and moves you, and you might not be a great poet, but you'll get your point across. That was the sort of premise that he talked about.
That's about that his democratic ideal that anybody can do the work. A poet, poets are not different sorts of creatures living in some other firmament. They're people among us. I've got to tell you, the collaborators, the writing group that Phil founded and is still struggling along without him, has brought people into it who had never even thought of themselves as writers or poets and that sort of thing, and yet they would rise to the occasion because of the affirmative atmosphere, not just nurturing, because we'd be critical too. Even Phil's barber got intrigued hearing about him, talking about it on sitting in the barber chair, and she came in for a couple of years and wrote a couple of very interesting personal historical poems. a different quality altogether than I would write, than anybody else there would write, but held my interest because she learned certain principles: be specific, use concentrated language, try to be try to capture that attention and hold it. So I think I'm addressing your question, Phil.
Certainly, and yeah. You addressed the collaborators, which you and Eve Ott are a part of, Randy. Mm-hmm. Collaborators, not exactly subtle, but definitely direct. You're collaborating. How did you come up with that name, Eve, as we prepare to hear your poem, Trips?
I honestly don't know. The collaborators started before I moved to Kansas City.
But you became one.
I became one, and I knew Phil for many, many years. We both went to Emporia State University, studied with the same teacher, as did Randy. So there was a connection there immediately when I came to Kansas City. But I don't know where the – do you know where the name came from?
I never heard it described, but Phil, of course, came through college in the 60s, and I think there may be a kind of joking reference in the name to, counterculture political struggles or something like that, we're that kind of people.
Right.
Even though we
subversive
were really just writers sitting around scribbling. And, yeah, exactly. right. Something subversive about
right,
it.
Right. Eve, you wrote a poem in honor and in memory of Phil Miller that you're going to share with us now, Trips. Give us a little bit of a pregame on Trips.
Okay. Trips was written after what turned out to be the last time I ever saw Phil alive or otherwise. And a group of us made the trip to Pennsylvania to visit him. He was in remission from the leukemia that finally did defeat him. He looked great despite his bald head. He was full of energy and talk. And we were full of a very tenuous and almost frightened hope that he would make it.
Let's hear Trips by Eve Ott.
Okay, Trips for Phil Miller. I don't want to think about getting there. All the waiting called flight. Then the car rental, misturns, backtracks, kind of like life if I think about it, which I'd rather not. I want to remember arriving in September, barely. So the music in the living room was the September collection. Autumn in New York, September song, of course. Performers mostly from the big band era. The leaves of brown came tumbling down, remember? In the bathroom, the Beatles. Now that ought to get things moving. In the guest rooms, more September songs, this time Lottie's version, with more from Kurt. After hugs, welcome, wonderful food and drink, Phil is that miracle of AA who does not flip an eyebrow, pull a scowl when someone wants, heck, needs, a drink after a long day. And all along, conversation, free range, from politics to art to just plain gossip, from poetry to poverty to historic trends. And where are we now? Where are we now? Phil reminded me of the first time I stayed at his house after a long, raucous evening, just friends of a friend then, back when we were young. My God, we were young. When Phil was drinking, and I liked him. Phil is not drinking now, and I like him. Phil says I walked in and said, ah, civilization. I don't remember the words. I do remember the feeling that persists. Civilization, in all its bizarre inconsistencies, ironies, pathos, and side-splitting nuttiness, misturns, backtracks, the whole tedious journey that brings us here, wherever here is, still pondering together the moments of beauty, and that's all of them. In the morning, there will be classical, perhaps Schubert, Telemann, strong, dark coffee, the smell of toast. Dust motes dance in a slice of sunlight from an east window. And we are grateful for one more day. One more day.
Trips by Eve Ott. Poets Eve Ott and Randy Ratliff are here discussing the life, work, character, and approach of the late, great Phil Miller, his work and influence, which will culminate in an open mic at the Writer's Place this Sunday afternoon. Eve, what was Phil Miller's obsession with ghosts and supernatural elements, metaphysical elements in poetry, as we get into Randy's reading of some of his ghost-related stuff?
Actually, that's a topic that can be and has been debated. Phil was a very down-to-earth person, not given to any out-of-experiences, you know. But this is my personal take on all the ghost poems. Phil was an observer. And an observer is somewhat like a ghost, taking it all in, but invisible himself. And I think that was the root of a good many of them. Now, it could be argued that he did believe in such things as ghosts, and perhaps he did, but I never saw any indication of that.
Randy, the ghost as a silent observer?
Phil's ghosts, what I find refreshing about them is that they're not gothic spook story ghosts, and they're not spirits spoken of in metaphysics or anything like that. They're Phil's own ghosts, and there seems to be consistently with them the idea that they're just kind of hanging out in, I suppose, what some people would call a limbo or something. But they are insubstantial and aware of themselves as such, and aware of their former selves, and watching us. And the interesting thing in the poem is the ghost being aware of how his feelings have changed from being a substantial to an insubstantial person, and how his feelings about the rest of the world have changed.
So which piece are you going to read? You're going to read The Ghost of Every Day or The Ghost in the Window?
Ghost of Every Day.
All right, let's go.
All right. You'd think a ghost would haunt old friends or relatives, but you run out quickly, get tired of them here. There's only so much left to find out. And they still tell lies. Why not? No answers here. And without a clock, you can muse on forever, though some do seek God, never asking themselves, if he's not here, where the hell is he? So it boils down to you or any ordinary working stiff, as I once was. You're the one I haunt. What else to do to find out what really happens? I watch you sneak off to your girlfriend and see what you can't see. Your wife, as the door closes behind you. She knows. But what would scare you more is how quickly she forgets all about it. Turns to a magazine, TV, something to distract with a laugh or two or a cheap thrill. And this is why I come to haunt. She fixes a cup of coffee. Maybe a stiff drink, sits and stares into the fire, her eyes picking up its hot sparks, or into a shadowy corner where quiet sticks of furniture reside, table, chair, lamp, ottoman, going over them in her mind like artifacts, how they usually outlive us. So when he finally drags himself home, she's still up, and they exchange a glance I was born to see. He trying to read her eyes, she trying to remember who he is.
That was Ghost of Every Day by Phil Miller, read by Randy Ratliff. Our guests are Randy Ratliff and Eve Ott, discussing the life and legacy of Phil Miller. Mr. Miller was an editor of some periodicals, which included Same Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
As we close with this thought, he says all of the magazines tried to be different, but were the same.
Yes.
What does that thought mean to you?
It was a joke, first and foremost, that speaking against novelty, saying that we're trying to do something good, not just something new. Can I say briefly about the event this Sunday? It is an event to raise funds for the Phil Miller Memorial Scholarship for an English major. All the proceeds will be going to that scholarship, and we do invite folks to come and read with us 2 to 4 at the Writer's Place.
Poets Randy Ratliff and Eve Ott, thank you for joining us today on Central Standard to talk about Phil Miller, as he mentioned, Sunday from 2 to 4 at the Writer's Place. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, another tale of divergent artistic viewpoints, individual tastes and talents. A Kansas City filmmaker takes us inside the world of a funk punk band in his new documentary, Fishbone.
The sun would shine, take me to another place in my life, where everything is beautiful,
and no wants to need,
no sanity to rule our soul. I wish
every day is sunshine.
And welcome back to Central Standard. In the late 1970s and early 80s, a funny thing happened in Los Angeles. Forced desegregation of city schools, a phenomenon that permeated across the country and in L.A. This produced the artistic exploits of people such as Ice Cube and, as we're about to find out, an obscure funk punk band of black kids from South Central called Fishbone. Joining us now is Chris Metzler, a co-director of Everyday Sunshine. The title track you just heard, Everyday Sunshine, The Story of Fishbone, is the documentary. Chris, welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, thanks for having me.
When did you first start listening to Fishbone?
You know, what's kind of funny is, actually, I hadn't heard my first Fishbone song until I decided to make this documentary, I guess about 4 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I always feel guilty because back in the early 90s when I went to school at USC in Los Angeles, the band actually played a free concert on campus, and a roommate invited me to go see this band, Fishbone, and I was familiar with them just because, you know, in the early 90s, the Fishbone logo was everywhere on, you know, skateboarders and alternative punks. And when he described the music to me, I was like, who wants to listen to that? And, of course, I've been regretting that since that day.
And since then, you've called them one of the most unique funk bands to come out in the last 25 years. A little context, you went to USC and studied a little bit, as John Singleton did, in that film school, knowing that South Central, a lot of people call it the University of South Central.
Right.
So tell us about Fishbone and how that whole culture and ethic makes them one of the most unique bands to come out in the last 25 years.
Well, it's really interesting. Fishbone was kind of coming up a time, like, you know, first kind of generation of, you know, kind of post-Civil Rights generation of African-Americans that, you know, had a lot of opportunities. And, of course, there's just a lot of kind of also kind of social chaos and upheaval going on in Los Angeles. I mean, Los Angeles is a very diverse city, but it's also very segregated. You know, the kind of elevated concrete freeways and things really kind of separate communities. And so five of the Fishbone guys grew up in South Central L.A., and in the late 70s, there was a desegregation busing program. And so these five kids were bused out to the kind of predominantly white suburbs in the valley where they met the one black kid in school, Angelo. And they all kind of fell in love with punk rock, but they also mixed in a lot of other music that they were listening to, you know, from R&B and reggae to ska and funk. And they basically just kind of melded all together into this kind of unique sound that went on to influence bands like the Red Hot Chili Peppers and No Doubt, but also, you know, bands like Outkast and the Black Eyed Peas.
Kevin emails in to share with us. Back in the 90s, he says he saw Fishbone with Red Hot Chili Peppers and Thelonious Monk at the University of Kansas Union, one of the best shows he said he's ever seen musically, and defined a long period of his life. Can't wait to catch the documentary. But let's get back to you, Mr. Pale Griot, as you call yourself. Talk about this whole thing that you found out in your documentary, this backstory. You were a white kid from Kansas City going to SC, which is dead off in the middle of mid-city, South Central is what we call it. Mm-hmm. Talk about how black city kids going to school in predominantly white neighborhoods such as the San Fernando Valley produce not only their sound, but their attitude.
Well, I think, you know, there's a couple things. Is that, you know, the guys that, you know, made up a Fishbone is that, you know, they were all probably going to wind up musicians anyways, you know? And they're all, you know, really curious, you know, guys in the sense that they probably would have always played lots of different music. But because of the busing situation, what you have is that, you know, you're in L.A., you're getting bused, you know, an hour and a half each way. So you're spending, you know, 3 hours on the bus each day. And so, of course, you have time to be able to kind of talk and discuss things. And so these six kids that probably wouldn't have formed a band together, based on this kind of forest busing, they got a chance to hang out and decide to find, you know, form a band together on this kind of democratic concept where everybody was going to be equal, you know? And so that's kind of how the sound got created. And, you know, to be honest, is that once the, you know, one of the things that Norwood's bassist and kind of founder of Fishbone talks about is that, you know, once he was out there in the valley, he kind of just recognized that there was this kind of life outside his neighborhood. Not that he wasn't proud and happy with his own neighborhood, but there was just a lot of diversity out there. And from that point on forward, they just kind of embraced, like, look, let's kind of discover as many different things out there and then kind of interpret it then through our own voice. And I think that's the thing that made Fishbone unique. And then, let alone, they wanted to be great entertainers in the sense that they wanted to put on a great stage show, be better than everybody else, and basically, you know, wow the audience and make the audience feel that they were participants in the concerts. They really kind of took that punk rock ethos in the sense that, you know, it's not only Angelo, the lead singer, you know, stage diving and joining the mosh pit, but basically anybody in the band might wind up in the crowd at some point in time in a Fishbone concert.
Fish is all permeating all throughout this. Fish Bones, people with the nicknames Fish. Speaking of Fish, there's another guy with the nickname of Fish, a.k.a. Lawrence Fishburne. How did you get Fish, Lawrence Fishburne, to narrate this movie?
Well, you know what's funny is, so Lawrence has been a friend and a fan of the band for a long time. And the way he discovered them, he was actually working as a bouncer at some Hollywood punk rock clubs in the early 80s, which is actually kind of surprising given, you know, he was already in, like, Apocalypse Now and some other great
this
movies.
Was back when he was Larry Fishburne.
When he was Larry, yeah. And one day he was, like, working the door, and he heard this racket that was kind of danceable, and he's like, okay, well, I'm going to go check out this band. And he was like, wait, these are six black guys playing this music? And so he kind of, you know, approached them afterwards, and they formed a friendship. And, you know, when we decided we wanted to do a narration, we wanted, obviously, someone with a great voice, which, you know, Lawrence has, but then also somebody that was kind of personally familiar with the band. And so when we approached him, he kind of jumped out and said, hey, let's do it. And I think one of the reasons why Lawrence really always admired Fishbone was, you know, he could see their talent, he liked their music and them, their kind of way of doing things differently. You know, he also liked them just as individuals, as, you know, kind of cool people to hang out with. But particularly in the 80s, you know, Fishbone, you know, dealt with some difficulties with marketing the band, you know, based on the color of their skin in the sense of, like, how do we market this, you know, all-black band that's playing what was considered, like, you know, white music, at least in the industry. And Lawrence kind of felt that, you know, he was kind of typecast in different roles, and so he kind of saw that they were in this kind of same struggle to kind of just, like, just be recognized as individuals versus being kind of classified, you know, based on some narrow stereotypes that some people in the entertainment industry had at the time. Probably still do.
It's interesting that you mention genre. We had cultural critic Nelson George on the show maybe a couple of weeks back, and he talked about how black people from, whether they be urban or rural neighborhoods, kind of invent something and then literally just move on. They had just come out of the Parliament Funkadelic generation, which was very popular of the generation right before them, Fishbone's generation right before them. And they have those inflections. They even talked in the Bootsy Collins vernacular, Baby Baba and all that stuff. Yet they weren't received by their contemporaries. They came straight out of Parliament Funkadelic, P-Funk, but they weren't really received by the sort of new wave gang street culture.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of amazing, you know, particularly in South Central Los Angeles, how things changed so, you know, severely in, you know, in the early 80s. I mean, you know, South Central Los Angeles, obviously the stereotype that I think many people have, at least in the 80s, is, you know, this is a place where, you know, there's kind of gang wars going on and there's this kind of crack epidemic. And those are, you know, two things that were really going on in the guys' neighborhoods and, you know, influenced their songwriting too. But I think one of the things they were always surprised by is that when they were growing up in the 70s, you know, people in their neighborhood were listening to lots of different music, you know. And then sometime in the 80s, you know, the music industry kind of segregated in the sense of, like, hey, here's this new kind of rap hip-hop genre. And basically, you know, if you're African-American, that's the sort of music you should play. And, you know, if you're white, you play, you know, kind of, you know, rock and roll or metal. And it was just one of those things that always surprised them. They're like, wait, we grew up listening to all this, you know? Why are people, you know, kind of categorizing it in such narrow ways? What is funny is that actually a lot of the people involved in the kind of rap and hip-hop genre really admired Fishbone for what they were doing, you know. And in reality, a lot of people in the neighborhood was like, we don't really understand what you're doing, and we don't particularly like it, but there's something special about it, so, you know, keep on doing what you're doing. We're just not going to come to the shows.
Right. Chris, I don't know. How old are you, Chris?
37.
Okay, 37. So you remember there was this little age right between the 70s and the early 80s, right before 85, when Dr. Dre used to wear a stethoscope and a glitter outfit. And Ice Cube and all those guys were wearing robot outfits, and Ice-T was wearing robot sort of outfits. There was this very, very, very sort of futuristic thing. You know Ice-T today is a guy with the shades and the gangs, and Ice Cube and all those guys, they're very tough. But there was this just sort of three-year period. How did Fishbone diverge from that period in the shadow of NWA, in the shadow of a harder core Ice-T in the groups of that area? How did they diverge from that? Because Ice-T and Dre and all those guys, they became tough.
Right.
But Fishbone went another way. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, Fishbone kind of always embraced their kind of inner cartoon character, you know, in the sense that they thought they were funny, and they were funny. And so they kind of just went for kind of the wacky look, you know. And so at first when Fishbone kind of broke out, it was this kind of like mod fashion cool part of the kind of ska scene in the early 80s. But as it went along, they just kind of really, in a way, it was like, you know, Parliament Funkadelic on acid sort of thing. And just the sense of like, let's just get it as kind of wacky and loopy and let's have a good, you know, party time. Now, as Fishbone evolved, you know, once the kind of early 90s kind of hit, then the band kind of decided to get a little bit more serious, you know, in the sense that, you know, there were things that going on in society that they wanted to comment on, and they felt that maybe they weren't being taken seriously. And, you know, in that sense, then they went kind of a little bit more of a harder edge, but with a kind of alternative rock grunge sort of look, you know? And I think that's the thing that's always, you know, kind of interesting about Fishbone is that they're usually always, you know, embracing several different things at the same time, so they become really difficult to define.
They were signed to Columbia Records, so this is not a ragtag sort of cult phenomenon that it seems like today. They were actually signed to a very large record label at the time. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Fishbone, you know, just kind of like blasted out of the L.A. scene, just red hot in 1984. They were signed to Columbia Records right out of high school. In fact, actually, Fish, the drummer, was still in high school at the time. They released an EP, starts getting played on the radio, they're going on tours, and, you know, Columbia Records really kind of believed that this was the band was going to be the next big thing. And they released a series of four or five albums on Columbia Records, each one where everybody just figured it's going to break. And unfortunately, while they always got kind of critical success, the album sales were never quite there, even though, you know, Fishbone's concerts were always packed just because they were known, you know, as good times. And around that time, I think there's two things that, you know, kind of made it difficult for Fishbone to kind of break out. Is that one is, you know, the Red Hot Chili Peppers kind of adapted Fishbone sound and kind of
yeah,
right
sure did.
Funk. Yeah. And once they broke out, it was kind of like, well, that's the next, you know, big band. There isn't room for another one. And the other thing is that, you know, Living Color kind of broke out in, you know, 89, I guess. And it was kind of like, okay, well, they're the black rock band, you know? And so once the kind of two categories that Fishbone could maybe be categorized in, you know, were kind of filled, it became a little bit more difficult to say. People kind of said, okay, well, you know, if you weren't familiar with the band, you're like, okay, well, they're just kind of following the leads of these other bands, where in fact, you know, Fishbone was actually the groundbreakers and trendsetters there.
You're listening to Kansas City native Chris Metzler, co-director of Everyday Sunshine, the story of Fishbone, premiering this weekend at the Screenland Theater in the Crossroads. I'm Jabalani LaFall. You're tuned in to Central Standard on KCUR and streaming live on KCUR.org. Chris, growing up in Kansas City, the home of bebop jazz and some swing, what did you listen to? And then we'll get back into how Fishbone sort of got caught in that middle between Living Color and Red Hot Chili Peppers and sort of imploded from within. But talk about Kansas City and your musical tastes.
Well, you know, I think my musical tastes have expanded over the years, but when I was growing up in Kansas City, actually, I probably was listening to a lot of 80s hard rock and 1970s John Denver, Christopher Gale, country music sort of thing. And, yeah, those are the sort of albums that I remember having. And, you know, it wasn't that I wasn't curious about other things. It's just that, you know, that was what was sounding good at the time, you know. You know, since that point in time, you know, lived, you know, listened to a lot of, you know, classical and, you know, freeform jazz, but then also, you know, kind of electronica and Britpop. And, you know, in some ways, one of the things that, you know, the more that you read and the more you kind of explore in the world, you just realize how kind of interconnected things are and just kind of appreciating differences. And so I think that's one of the things that kind of has happened over time. But, in growing up in Kansas City, I mean, this is where kind of it all started for me in the sense that I grew up outside Independence, Missouri, and, you know, every weekend once I had a car, it was like about heading to Kansas City and just kind of seeing what was going on, you know, whether walking around and looking at people or, you know, attending a club show or just hanging out in a coffee shop. And, you know, one of the things that always kind of attracted me to the Fishbone story is that, you know, was definitely, you know, familiar with some of the kind of, you know, kind of desegregation efforts, you know, in Kansas City in the 80s. In fact, my younger brother, you know, we grew up in rural Independence, Missouri, and, you know, he started attending some of the magnet schools in Kansas City, and I remember this, like, taxi cab would, like, show up at 5 o'clock in the morning and pick him up and drive him all over to Southeast, you know, where he'd go to high school, you know? And, you know, he absolutely loved the experience, but, you know, it was definitely, you know, a bit of an effort, you know, in the sense of the sort of drive, you know, to do each day.
What made you move to L.A.? And then we'll get into what made you want to do a film about a band from somewhere else.
Well, I moved to L.A. Just because I think I was looking to move somewhere warmer and, you know, a big kind of megalopolis, you know, sort of city. You know, I grew up my entire life in Kansas City, and so it was just kind of nice to, you know, go somewhere new. And, you know, what's interesting is actually I think my freshman orientation was like a week after, you know, the L.A. riots. And, you know, all people are like, you sure you want to go to L.A. still? And I was like, well, I'll go give it a shot. If it, you know, if it's not something I like, I'll, you know, come back. And just really fell in love with being able to explore this new city. And, of course, USC has this great film school. And while I didn't know I wanted to be a filmmaker when I headed out there, within the first couple weeks I realized that a lot of the things that I liked about life or, you know, was kind of passionate about kind of fit into this umbrella of filmmaking. And, you know, then started studying film there and, you know, making films both out there during school, but then also during my summers when I came back to Kansas City.
So let's get back to Fishbone, the group that you became enamored with when you moved out to L.A. from Kansas City. This was a group with so much promise. But as you mentioned earlier, they kind of fell into a genre development hell, so to speak, between Red Hot Chili Peppers and Living Color. Gangsta rap was coming online. There was no place to go. So what happened to them?
Well, there was a couple of things that happened. Fishbone continued to release albums and, you know, write new music. And in some ways, because each time they were kind of always ahead of the curve. It's like, you know, they were doing alternative rock, you know, kind of grunge stuff before that was big. And then once grunge hit, they kind of went more underground and punk rock again. One of the unfortunate things that happened is that, you know, there was this kind of implosion from inside. One of the original guitarists and kind of lead songwriter, Kendall, left the band suddenly, you know, found God, joined what the band considered a cult. And the band kind of staged an intervention, you know, that resulted in kidnapping charges and them facing 15 to 20 years in jail. They were lucky enough to be found not guilty, but that kind of derailed some of their commercial prospects because, you know, record labels kind of, labeled them as a hassle, and this happened when they were on Lollapalooza, you know, and there was a time when, like, the music industry was definitely getting more corporate and just like, look, we don't need these sorts of problems. And so the band went underground and has continued to tour relentlessly, you know, over the years and released new music, you know, kind of outside the, you know, the spotlight. And this happens to be the 25th anniversary of the, you know, the band's EP release. And they just had a new album come out a couple weeks ago, Crazy Glue. And they're out there and have just kind of always kind of pursued, you know, their kind of artistic muse, you know, wherever it took them, you know. And I think that was the thing that was always interesting about Fishbone is that they kind of carved their own path in the sense that they understood the risks and rewards of trying to do something different and not necessarily sell out. But in the end, they wanted to do something that they themselves could be passionate about.
You approach this documentary from a very straightforward way. It's not the campy, sad breakup of the typical behind-the-music documentary. What made you take this different, more objectively real route?
Well, I think the thing is that I always kind of found that most music documentaries suck in the sense that, you know, they're built for fans, you know, in the sense that if you don't like the band's music or you're not familiar with it, there's not really much there. And so we wanted to kind of explore a band from the inside out, you know, as these really interesting characters. The thing that really interested me about Fishbone was that, you know, they're, you know, a bunch of idiosyncratic, eclectic guys that are really interesting, you know, and have an interesting life. And in reality, you know, the story of the film is a story about friendship and what it takes to kind of remain friends amidst these kind of difficult hardships.
What are the members of Fishbone doing today?
What's that?
What are the members of Fishbone doing today?
The Fishbone is basically a band that's, you know, out there, you know, probably out 75% of the time out on tour, you know, playing shows and gigging it, and then when they're back at home, writing new music.
And what do they think about the documentary, and how has what they went through in their 25 years shaped their sound today?
Well, I think they're all very happy with the film. I think there's some moments on screen that are difficult for them to see sometimes and makes them uncomfortable. They kind of always see it a little bit a bit surreal, but in the end, they're really happy with what we've done and feel that it's a, you know, really captures, you know, what happened during our times with the band, but also, you know, what kind of Fishbone's all about, you know? And that's really about the story of these outsiders, these guys that never really fit in anywhere but fit in everywhere at the same time. And their music today, you know, it's like, if you listen to their new album, it's like there's a ska song, there's a reggae song, there's a punk song, and there are songs that just, like, mix it all up together. And they're really, you know, kind of representative of the kind of new and more diverse and multicultural world that we live in.
You mentioned that the music industry has gotten a lot more corporate, which it has. The music industry has gotten a lot more diluted with the advent of digital music and the advent of file sharing and different outlets and distribution points. Where does Fishbone fit in 2011?
Well, in some ways, it's like the perfect storm. You know, it's like it's the right time for Fishbone to kind of break out, you know, in the sense that, you know, the power is kind of being handed back to the individual artists and bands. And, you know, Fishbone is a band that, even if you've just seen them once, you know, you remember that for life, you know? And so they're able to kind of, create this kind of grassroots phenomenon and reach out directly to their fans to be able to tour and, you know, sell albums. And so if they continue to develop that, then obviously they have kind of a stronghold where they can continue to do this, you know, until they're 80 years old, you know, because that's what they've been doing and intend to do.
Sean from the local band Red Kate wrote in to us at centralstandard@kcur.org with a memory of Fishbone. He says, my first Fishbone show was at the Outhouse in Lawrence, the punk rock mecca of the Midwest in the 1980s. Lawrence was, he says. It was Fishbone and Nota in 1986, N-O-T-A in 1986. Being from a small rural town in Kansas, Sean says, he'd never been to any sort of underground music venue before. Words, Sean says, can't describe the experience. And it literally changed my life from that point on. I immersed myself in the punk rock music scene, joined a band, and have been playing punk rock and roll music ever since. Thank you, Sean, for those words. He says he's basically never been the same ever since. Is that the experience?
Yeah, and I mean, I can speak for myself that that's true. But the thing that we've found as we've kind of toured with the film, both film festivals and here now theatrically, is that people come to us and just say, you know, Fishbone changed my life. It was the one place where I always felt like I could belong, you know? If I felt like I didn't, you know, was, you know, kind of outsider in my own community, I felt welcome. I didn't need to be like Fishbone. Fishbone gave me permission just to kind of be myself, and that was what was special about them.
What's your next project after this 60-city tour of this Fishbone documentary?
I'm working on a kind of more fly-on-the-wall documentary about this deportation hotel for illegal immigrants in Mexico. And so it's kind of a story about, you know, these people whose lives have been kind of turned upside down and this kind of week that they're allowed to stay at the hotel while they kind of figure out what their next step in life is.
You're coming to Kansas City tomorrow for this Q&A and to screen this documentary out in the Crossroads. If you could do a documentary on anything about Kansas City, Chris, give me your pitch right now. What would it be?
Well, I'm sure that there's some sort of unexplored jazz and bebop history that would be great to explore, but I think that there's something, you know, within the kind of like kind of the farming and river sort of life that I think that's there. I'm not sure what it is, but I think there's probably a great story about the Missouri River that could be told.
Our guest is Kansas City native Chris Metzler, co-director of Everyday Sunshine, the story of Fishbone, premiering this weekend at the Screenland Theater in the Crossroads. And he'll be in town Friday at the Screenland Theater in the Crossroads for an audience Q&A. That's on Friday. We're going to go out to the song Party at Ground Zero by Fishbone. Chris Metzler, thank you so much for joining us on Central Standard.
Much appreciated. Keep on rocking.
All right. Let's rock it. And tune in tomorrow for the Walt Bodine Show with the Food Critics. They'll be discussing where to find the best burgers in the city. Kim Noble is our announcer. Emily Muter manages our website. Our multimedia producer is Tamika Weatherspoon. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi and executive produced by Bill Anderson. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney. What you're hearing now is Ground Zero from the Fishbone Band. The screening will be this Friday. Up to date is next with the history of drunk driving in America. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.